and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gridonis. Deacon Gridonis is he's the owner and proprietor of DecentFilms.com. He writes for the National Catholic Register as a film critic, for Catholic Digest. You just see him popping up all over the place. Are you still doing your 60-second reviews? Is that a thing? Or
It is. We mostly do them during the summer and during the holiday season when Real Faith is in session. In the past, I have trekked into the city to do 60-second reviews, even in the off season. But I haven't been doing that lately. I've been much more of a homebody, much less in Manhattan. I've gone to fewer screenings. I'm doing more Deacon stuff these days.
Okay. Well, that's cool. And of course, you're like, I don't know, like the closest personal friend in the world of Martin Scorsese, right? maybe I'm exaggerating. I don't know. It just seems like it to me. But
Well, the guy still doesn't return my phone calls, but at least he knew my name.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. So, it's been a while since I've done a podcast. There's been a lot of water under the bridge this month, especially. I went on vacation right after Charlottesville. So we went off to the coast. There's an ocean city over here in Washington, as well as out there in New Jersey.
Ah, that's where we were. Were you also in Ocean City?
We were also in Ocean City, but on the Pacific coast. So yeah, it's this huge, endless expanse of beach that just goes north and south, literally off into like these primordial mists. You look until you just can't see anything anymore, because it's all shrouded in mists that either dinosaurs or imperial walkers should come stomping out of.
That sounds like it's not just a different city, but a whole different ocean.
It is an entirely different ocean. And Ocean City is, shall we say, city is a bit of an exaggeration when it comes to this town that's really kind of more like a strip mall that's got a street running through it. But the big thing that everybody goes there for is the beach. And so you sit there on the beach, or if you're like my wife, who's a bit crazy about these kinds of things, you march out into the great rolling surf, because there's nothing once you leave the shore until you hit Japan. It's just nothing but Pacific Ocean after that. And so you can look off into infinity and contemplate your tininess in the grand scheme of things out on Ocean City. And the other thing that you think about, or that I think about all the time when I'm at Ocean City, is an essay that was done for the New Yorker magazine a couple of years ago called The Really Big One. And it's talking about the Cascadia Fault that lies about 30 miles off the coast. And the Cascadia Fault, roughly on average every 400 years, suddenly gives way in colossal, violent subterranean earthquakes, because that's where the Pacific Plate is subducting under the North America Plate. And just to give you some sense of the kind of power we're talking about, in the year 1700, the last time the Cascadia Fault gave way in a quake, the whole of the east coast of Japan was obliterated by a tsunami that killed a whole generation of Japanese. It was a huge traumatic event. And part of the reason for the trauma is because normally the Japanese knew that there was going to be a tsunami because there was a big earthquake like right off their shores. This one happened off our shores, and it sent a tsunami wave across the Pacific that obliterated the east coast of Japan. It also sent another tsunami wave that created, among other things, there is a huge sub-aquatic forest out off the coast of Oregon it's a forest that was suddenly plunged into the ocean after the same quake that destroyed Japan. And when it goes again, the experts are basically saying, just write off everything in Northern California, Oregon, and Washington west of I-5. Because it's all going to be wiped out. So you sit there on a beach thinking about these things as you realize that if there's a quake, you've got a couple of minutes to run as fast as you possibly can back to your car and then just get the hell out of there as fast as you can heading inland. And the odds are not good that you'll survive. So these are all, you know, relaxing things that you think about while you're out on the beach when you live here in Washington. So, but
you know, I went out on the beach in Ocean City, New Jersey, and I didn't think about any of that stuff.
Well,
I made another Jesus crucifix in
sand.
I saw it.
It was quite beautiful.
Thank you.
Yes, you've missed your calling as a sculptor.
No, okay. But I do enjoy doing it as a diversion on summer vacation.
Okay. Well, you did good. You did good. You could have done that if I'd thought to do it. And if I had like any talent whatsoever for sculpting, which I don't, with our nice wet, hard, you know, packable sand, but I did not do that because I suck and I'm a failure. So, one of the things that happened was the Charlottesville, the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, which was, of course, it was a shameful spectacle of Nazis, KKK, white supremacists coming together, and culminated in the murder of a woman named Heather Heyer, who was part of the counter protesters group. And the, you know, that was appalling. But what was even more appalling was the fact that the president of the United States, Donald Trump, could not bring himself, without being dragged, kicking and screaming, to simply condemn Nazis, KKK, and white supremacists. He couldn't do it. And even after he was dragged, kicking and screaming, to do it, and this happens repeatedly with Trump, is he's given a script and told by his aides, just say the words, damn it. And so he grudgingly eats his broccoli and says what they tell him to do. And then the next day, without fail, he tells you what he really thinks, which is exactly what he did. So he went off script on, they were having some meeting about infrastructure or something. And he just had to say, you know, that many of the people who were marching with the Nazis were nice people. Fine people, that was the word that he used. These are people who were chanting, Jews will not replace us.
And blood and soil, and Black Lives Splatter, and carrying Nazi memorabilia, and so forth. Yeah. Right. And, you know, he wanted to make the point that there were violent people on the other side, which is true. There were people on both sides who went to Charlottesville with violent intent and prepared for violence. Mm-hmm. There were also a lot of people protesting Nazis in Charlottesville who were perfectly peaceable and nice and decent people, as Trump himself admitted in the case of Heather Heyer.
Right.
Because when Nazis march in the street, that's what good and decent people do. They protest.
Right.
And the fact that there might be other people there who are violent, who have malicious intent, also being against the Nazis, is not going to stop you or me or any other decent people from protesting.
Right.
Now, if you happens to be an innocent citizen of Charlottesville and you were interested in protesting the removal of Confederate statues, and you suddenly found yourself surrounded by a sea of people holding torches and chanting blood and soil, I have to think that you would probably get the heck out of Dodge as fast as you could.
Right.
What do you think of this as a moral precept? I like formulating moral precepts.
Okay.
When there is a demonstration and a counter demonstration, if the demonstration is bad, it is always okay to be part of the counter demonstration.
Right.
But if the demonstration is bad, it is never okay to be part of the bad demonstration.
Right.
This seems pretty straightforward.
Oh, but you'd be surprised at how morally complex all this becomes for people who are bent on, what's the word I'm looking for? Defending Nazis. Yeah, I think that'll work. Because that's what we're talking about here. No. There were no fine people, none, in a crowd that's chanting Black Lives Spatter and offering Hitler salutes and carrying swastikas. And by the way, one of the excuses that's being made here is these are just people who wanted to preserve Southern heritage. Well, you know what? When you carry a Confederate flag and a swastika, you're not preserving Southern heritage, at least nothing good about Southern heritage.
And nothing even that, you know, that Confederate era or that Jim Crow era Confederates would recognize, Southerners would recognize as being part of their culture. One of the interesting dynamics in between the Confederacy and the Third Reich is that there were some leaders in the Third Reich who were kind of interested in American Southern culture. And that interest was cordially not returned by the Southerners, who were just as anti-Nazi and even more so in some yes. cases than the Northerners were.
Right.
The Southern good old boys may not have thought a whole lot more of their black neighbors than the goose stepping Nazis across the pond, but that did not make them friends.
Right.
You know. Until it did.
Well, it's,
and
that's the thing. What's notable, by the way, is that state of Mississippi, for example, did not celebrate the 4th of July until 1944, after the Civil War. What was happening in 1944 that might have inspired even the state of Mississippi, you know? To say we're more Americans, but you're right. That is all changed, and it has all changed for one reason. There's a reason that rally was not called "Unite the Nazis," and it was not called "Unite the KKK." It was called "Unite the Right," and the reason it was called "Unite the Right" was because these people saw themselves, David Duke in interviews at Charlottesville, saw themselves as fulfilling the promise of Donald Trump. They got his message very, very clearly. And they, by the way, they got very, very clearly the message that he sent in his condemnation. The essence of Trump's condemnation was... everybody was equally guilty of violence, especially the counter-protesters, and everybody was equally fine people, especially the Nazis. That was the essence of the message that he sent, and the white supremacists got that. They sent messages to one another. We can see them on the internet saying Trump was fantastic. He totally exonerated us. He said very clearly the message that he's not going to condemn us and all the rest of it. And they got that. And everybody watching it got that, except for his defenders, who, to their shame, overwhelmingly self-identify as conservative Christians, Catholic and Protestant. You know, while everybody, you had corporate leaders, you had Republicans, a few of them, but I forget, I think it was something like 20% of the GOP did its standard thing of kind of wringing their hands and saying, we feel bad about this. Golly, it's bad. And then, you know, a couple of days later, they say, well, we're not going to do anything about it. But at least they spoke. But the only people defending this practically now are the diehard conservative pro-life Christians who have made excuses for all of this.
I do think it's interesting, too, from a Christian point of view, that a number of members of Trump's business council, his CEOs, the people that he works with to try to promote the interests of employers and hopefully the economy,
right,
have resigned. As a result of this.
Well, because they're not stupid.
Well, but for a while, it continued to be the case that zero members of Trump's evangelical council resigned over this. One of them has.
Right.
And the other ones are kind of standing firm.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, one of the things that you and I both talked about throughout this whole direction that our country has turned in is what is happening to the witness of the Christian community and to our moral credibility.
It's in ruins.
Well, and what lessons can we learn from the past in this regard? Because, you know, there's a lot of resistance. I don't imagine too many people like this are still listening to this podcast at this point, mm-hmm, after all the things that have been said. Mm-hmm. But there is a lot of resistance among American Christians. And when I say that, I mean white American Christians, mm-hmm, evangelical and Catholic, in acknowledging that racism continues to be a significant problem in any way in our culture today. What they'll say is, you know, yeah, okay, there's some white supremacists, KKK and so forth, marching down in Charlottesville. Well, you know, how big of a problem is that nationwide? I mean, realistically, even the Southern Poverty Law Center will tell you that KKK in this country number in the single-digit thousands. That's insignificant.
Right.
Neo-Nazi groups are not going to be, you know, significantly more than that. So we're talking about a teeny tiny problem here in terms of that, you know, that radical extreme expression. And that's very true.
Yes.
And so many people are going to want to look at racism as something that was basically solved in the civil rights era.
Right.
You know, all of that is done away with. And now what you just have is you have people, you know, marketing and hawking racism as a mode of social agitation.
Right.
And people resist very strongly the idea that, you know, people look at themselves and they say, well, I'm not racist. So, and my neighbors are, I don't know anybody who's racist. Why, where is the problem? I don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them only ever talk about the problem or talk about the question with other people who look like them, and they all agree they haven't seen or experienced racism, and so they feel like the problem is resolved.
Right.
But and it's important to recognize we have to admit that the church, the Catholic Church, and other Christian churches has not always decorated itself in glory in confronting these questions. Far from it.
Right.
There has been, you know, some progress in that regard, and some progress in other regards. We have certainly made progress in regard to the increasing stigmatization of racism and the kind of, you know, explicit over-the-top racism that was much more common in the past now no longer is, and that is progress.
Mm-hmm.
But when Pope John Paul II came to the United States in 1999, he went to St. Louis and he talked about what he called a great challenge for the whole country. And he named that challenge as putting an end to every form of racism. And echoing the U.S. bishops, he called it one of the most persistent and destructive evils of the nation. He's hearkening back there to a document 20 years old, a 1979 document of the USCCB called Brothers and Sisters to Us, which acknowledged, frankly, that despite advances and even significant changes, the reality of racism remains. So John Paul II is saying, you know, okay, it's 20 years later, but that problem is not gone away. And in the new millennium, that's going to continue to be a significant challenge for Christians, for Catholics. In 2015, 16 years later, at the USCCB General Assembly, President Archbishop Joseph Kurtz of Louisville, Kentucky, reaffirmed that.
Yeah.
He said, racism is an evil which endures in our society and in our church. And this continues to be the experience of Black Catholics.
Yeah.
Of Catholics of color, that they continue to face challenges which their white neighbors are often just largely blind to, which are invisible to them.
Right.
And people say, you know, well, why do we have to keep talking about racism? And, you know, well, one of the things we have to talk about is getting more on the same page so that we all recognize the problems that, that people still continue to face in the world right. today.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and the frankly, the election of Donald Trump is exhibit A. He ran on a racist ticket. He encouraged racial violence, both passively and aggressively. So, for example, you know, there was a couple of his followers, you know, explicitly saying that they were doing this. You know, in his name and for him, just beat the living crap out of some homeless Latino guy. This is a moment where a normal person says that was evil. And I absolutely repudiate that. Trump's response was, and I'm quoting here, my followers are very passionate. That is. That's not merely not repudiating it. It's praising an act of violence. Passionate people are good people. They're people who care and et cetera, et cetera. And that's been the consistent message that he sent. Periodically dragged to do it by his aides because his aides are freaking out due to his obvious support for this kind of stuff. He will read from some prepared statement like he did after Charlottesville. But the moment that prepared statement is taken away and he's given his Twitter feedback, then we, you know, he tells us what he really thinks and makes it very clear. I don't believe any of that garbage, you know. And he's made clear that he holds eugenics ideas, that people are not all equal. He said this. Not all people are created equal. You know, the genetically superior are those who are, you know, ordained to rule and reign and the rest of it. And that a man like that can have still undying support of people who claim the mantle of pro-life and who proclaim, you know, that they uphold the gospel is a massive scandal. And that's the real problem. You know, yeah, there's a few thousand Klan. Sure, you know, there aren't that many Nazis around. Granted, you know. But you know what? when the president of the United States is in their corner, that really, really matters.
Let's be clear on the nature of the evil that we're talking about. Mm. When we talk about racism, I think it's important to be clear what that is.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean necessarily an explicit theory of racial superiority or inferiority.
Right.
Doesn't mean, you know, some idea that a certain race was has been the subject of a primordial curse from biblical times. It doesn't mean that you don't acknowledge in theory that, you know, oh, all people are equal and everybody is has the same worth. Racism is something much more insidious than that, much more pervasive. It has a sociological dimension, but it also has a theological dimension.
Yeah.
The sociological dimension has to do fundamentally with this is a rather controversial word, but the word is privilege.
Yeah.
And the way that privilege works is we live in a world, in a country, in a society, in a culture where whites are not only the majority numerically, but also the majority controllers of wealth and of power and of popular culture. We live in a world that fundamentally defines whiteness as the norm, and anything else is an exception. And this has far-reaching effects on how race is perceived, not only by white people, but by all members of society.
Right.
Everyone lives in this world, in this cultural world where whiteness is defined as the norm. And this isn't just something that's in individual people's hearts. This is something that permeates the structures of society. It's something that's endemic in the culture. It's in the air we breathe and the water that we drink, and it affects us all.
Mm-hmm.
The theological dimension is that the gospel proclaims fundamentally, at the center of the gospel, is that God has sent Jesus Christ to restore the unity of divided humanity, to take away every barrier of hostility. St. Paul says particularly to take down the barrier of hostility between Jew and Gentile, making one new man of the two. But not only the barrier of hostility between Jew and Gentile, not only the division separating God from man, but every division separating human beings from one another. So neither Jew nor Greek, but also neither slave nor free, neither male nor female, St. Paul says. And we can add neither black nor white, neither Asian nor Indian nor Hispanic or Latino, neither rich nor poor, neither educated nor uneducated, neither citizen nor immigrant. Mm-hmm. So and then under all of that, under this gospel truth, is something even more fundamental, a primordial reality of creation, the unity of the human family.
Mm-hmm.
Baptism in Christ makes us brothers and sisters in a new and supernatural sense. But even prior to that, and this is something that's neglected by a lot of Catholics, I've even seen Catholics react against this suggestion when we talk about people who are not Christians as our brothers and sisters. Oh, Muslims are our brothers and sisters. I've seen, you know, Catholics get their hackles raised and say, aren't there our brothers and sisters? You know, well, Pope Pius XII thought so when he said all men are brothers and members of the same great human family. And Leo XIII thought so in Rerum Novarum when he said all men are children of the same common father who is God. So you have this fundamental unity of the human family. And then on top of that, you have the gospel reality that Christ has come to take away every division, particularly in the church, because the church is God's instrument for reuniting the human race. But even beyond the bounds of the church, the gospel should remove barriers so that we see all men, even those who are not Catholics, who are not baptized, as our brethren. And this makes racism not only a moral issue, but a theological issue. It is a form of heresy. In the words of that 1979 document, the USCCBI mentioned brothers and sisters to us. It says racism is more than one sin among many. It is a radical evil that divides the human family and denies the new creation of a redeemed world. That is what we're up against here.
Wow.
That's what we're talking about.
Yeah. And it is, you know, Bishop Robert Barron remarked, he wrote an essay just the other day called Charlottesville and Original Sin. And that's, it really is, I think, an apt image in saying that racism is the original sin in the American founding.
Yes.
And like
Bishop, you said that.
Yeah. And and like original sin, you know, I am an inveterate Platonist. I deeply believe in the power of my Irish gift of gab to just talk people into seeing the obvious. You know? consequently, I spend a lot of time talking with and getting frustrated that people don't listen to the obvious, you know.
Yes.
But
this is a frustration that I very much share.
Yeah. Just be reasonable and, you know, see that this is crazy, right? You know, well, that's not going to happen because that is, you know, the nature of sin always is that it blinds. It darkens the intellect, as the tradition puts it. And weakens the will and disorders the appetites. And all of those help to promote all kinds of human evils, including the evil of slavery. Why do we have slavery? We had slavery because, well, you know, at the end of the day, if you can force somebody else to do the heavy lifting and not even have to pay them, sure, says fallen man. You know? Why should I care about somebody else? I care about me. And that's, you know, that's where slavery comes from. And the other thing that happens with slavery to sin, as well as chattel slavery, is once you say yes to it, you know at some level that what you're doing is evil. And when you commit to evil, evil never just stands still. It follows you through time and history, and you have to keep rationalizing what it was you chose to do, and what it was your father chose to do, and what it was your grandfather chose to do, and all the people around you, and the whole civilization that you created and are complicit in. Well, that's your home. Those are the people you love. You can't say, you know, my civilization is founded on monstrous evil, because that's too painful to admit.
And in that vein, very much in that light, you know, many of us, even those of us who are, you know, have taken some kind of vocal stand against racism, we have a somewhat whitewashed view of our own heritage and our own past. You know, we watch Selma and we identify with Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights marchers and leaders. And in the big crowd scenes, we notice that there are Catholic clergy and nuns, as well as an Orthodox metropolitan, and our hearts swell with pride. And we feel like these are our people and this is our cause. But when you actually look back at the history of the church's record on this subject, you realize that history is full of a lot of the same kinds of people that we see today all around us. People who say, I'm a good person, I don't have to change, and I don't see the problem, you know, everything is fine.
Right.
So, you know, and this goes back to slavery. You know, you have Christian slave owners going to church on Sunday and hearing neither slave nor free, and then they go home on Monday and they beat their slaves.
Right.
And after the Civil War, you know, American Christians continued to live in a world that is still living memory for many people, a world of separate schools and separate restrooms and water fountains, a world of intimidation and lynchings.
Right. I have to remind myself, you know, when I look at the separate water fountains thing, or, well, there was actually a film earlier this year called Loving.
Yes, I saw it.
Yeah, it was about a decision that was made when I was, 8 years old? I think yes. This is within my lifetime that the United States of America had to freaking figure out that you can marry somebody of a different race and that's not illegal. You know, and that had to happen when I, you know, was watching, you know, Star Trek debut on TV for the first time. You know, it's just astonishing to me. And frankly, you know, I look at something like Charlottesville and the response of the freaking president of the United States, unable to say without equivocation that Nazism is bad, that is happening in the lifetime, the adult lifetime of my children, is astounding to me. But that's what original sin does. Original sin, you know, the whole nature of original sin is it perpetuates evil down through generations. That we're talking about, these are not simply one-off ethical decisions made some time back by our ancestors who are all dead and they don't affect us anymore. And so what was the occasion of the march, for example? The occasion of the march was that neo-Nazis see something very significant in Confederate statuary. They're not saying that stuff is history. They're saying that stuff is right now, and it really matters. And why does it matter? Because the purpose of that statuary, which was largely erected at the height of the KKK in the early 20th century, and then again, there was a burst of Confederate statuary going up during the Civil Rights Movement. Not during the Civil War or right after the Civil War, but rather the purpose of that statuary was to reinforce Jim Crow. And to say, you know your place, helots. That's what it's there for, and that's why those Nazis cared about it. And so that statuary becomes an expression of our original sin as a nation as well.
And while the church has stood against this at times and in places, and while its theology is certainly 100% against it, I'm gonna share something with you that I ran across recently, which I have to say took my breath away. In 1968, the Black Catholic Clergy Caucus met and delivered an indictment that is really astonishing. They said the Catholic Church in the United States, primarily a white racist institution, has addressed itself primarily to a white society. That's the Black Clergy, the Black Catholic Clergy Caucus. Now, that's a really, really strong statement. But 11 years later, in Brothers and Sisters, the USCCB offered a judgment that is not quite that strong, but it's at least converging. Too often, they said, the church in our country has been, for many, a white church, a racist institution.
Yeah.
So those are really, really hard words.
Yeah.
And in the world in which we live today, I think all of us have to look at what we can do to to change this? What can I do to have the backs of my neighbors and my brethren in Christ who are people of color? What can I do to challenge the assumptions that are just in the air and in the society that stem from the fact that people who look like me are the dominant holders of wealth and power and the dominant controllers of culture? That kind of changing perspective, going from complacency to owning the problem. This is something that Archbishop Chaput said is what we really need. He talks in his statement on the subject, and he says, if we want a different kind of country in the future, we have to start today with a conversion in our own hearts. But he also says an insistence on the same in others. And that, to me, is the money phrase, because it means my neighbor who doesn't see the problem, my neighbor who thinks I'm okay, I don't need to change. Mm-hmm. That's my problem. That's what I have to try to take that on. That's what trying to confront racism means in the end.
Yeah. Well, you know, and there's a certain dynamic here, of course. You know, the word racism, because paradoxically, we don't really believe in mercy most of the time. And so when we're confronted with a sin, our instinct is very rarely to say, do I do that? And do I need to bring that to confession? About a year ago, my little granddaughter, Seraphim, was her uncle Luke was babysitting her, and so Luke's daughter was not there, Lucy. So it was just Seraphim, and Seraphim went into Lucy's room, and she was playing in Lucy's room, you know, playing with her toys. And Luke just kind of poked his head in to check on her and see if everything was okay. And she was like ducked down behind some big toy of Lucy's and kind of peeking over the top of it at Luke when he walked into the room. And Luke walks in and says, are you having fun? And Seraphim replied, I didn't do it. Which I thought was magnificent. But I see that response so many times. So you look at something like Charlottesville, for example, and say, you know, that this is still happening. This is 2017 and this is still happening. And the president of the United States is unable to condemn it unequivocally. Means that there's a problem. Now, I think the normal, healthy response to that is, you know, whether you think that you have a problem or not, your first response should be, yes, there's a problem. We need to address this in some way. And the fact that so many millions of Americans, when confronted with something like that, their first and very often only response is, I didn't do it, says there's a problem. You're thinking just of yourself. You're worried that you are somehow, that somebody's blaming you, that you're going to be guilty, and you're so obsessed with yourself that you can't address the problem. And if you're that obsessed with yourself, chances are there's a problem here in some way. You know, the people who say, yeah, there is a real issue with racism, I've certainly been complicit in it. I mean, I've got a colleague at Pathos, a guy named Scott Eric Ault, who I think the world knows. And Scott was shocked. He wrote last year something that has haunted me ever since he wrote it. He said for years, lefties told him conservatives have a real problem with racism. And his response, in all honesty, just exactly like my response was, no, that's not what we're about. You're seeing things, you're imagining things. That's not real. And last year he was shocked to find himself repeatedly having to say to fellow conservatives, this is not what we're about. What are you doing cheering, you know, when Trump is calling for people to beat up minority protesters, carry him out on a stretcher? How can you be cheering for this, right? And it began to dawn on him, as it began to dawn on me, that all those warnings that we've been given for years, I wasn't looking. I was blind. And so I realized I have played a part in this, and I still continue to play a part in it in ways that I'm not conscious of, because I'm just now, realizing that, okay, this didn't end with the passage of the Civil Rights Act. There are still really huge problems.
There are.
Yeah. And so the bishops are right. They're just right. And our failure as a church is, in many ways, as is often the case, we're not actually listening to the teaching of the church. You know, you gave a homily on the Syrophoenician woman, the reading in the gospel this last Sunday.
Yes, and I've been drawing on it throughout our talk here today.
Right. Yeah. But what was striking was that, sadly, the majority, from what I could tell, of the commentary that you got, you pulled some of the quotes from commenters. These are people who, these are National Catholic Register readers. They see themselves as, the bulwark Catholics, the people who are standing against, watering down the gospel and all the rest of it. And their responses were things like, Steve, I forbid my daughters from dating black men. Am I a racist? Clearly a rhetorical question to which he expected a no.
Yeah. I told him yes.
Yeah. Well, because he is, of course.
Yes.
And other comments like, all the racism rage of late has more to do with Hillary losing an election than it does the South losing the Civil War. No. That's not the case. Both sides are to blame, but I put a greater blame on the counter protesters. In other words, the people who got run over by Nazis. They're the ones who are the really guilty party. And this, by the way, was common rhetoric during the civil rights era as well. It wouldn't be necessary for the KKK to use violence if the uppity black protesters were not throwing society into disarray and all the rest of it. All you libtards, a charming word, keep hustling race. When you hear the word race hustling, what that means is that by writing this homily, by giving this homily, somehow or other, your true aim is to profit in some way, financially. Which is a complete falsehood, because nothing pays like being a deacon. The final quote that you pulled, and the guilting continues. And again, what is that saying? Well, what it's saying is what my 3-year-old niece said. I didn't do it. Why do you think that someone is charging you with sin to feel guilty about?
Right. I've seen a number of really instructive and enlightening pieces on the subject of so-called white guilt from theorists who are people of color. Mm. And by and large, what they say is, I don't want you to feel white guilt. I don't care if you feel white guilt. Your white guilt is creepy and narcissistic, because it's one more way of making it all about you.
Right.
You know, it's, oh, these, you know, the race hustlers, they're trying to guilt us. They're trying to, it's all about white guilt. And no, it's about the nature of the system that we live in. It's a system that you didn't build and I didn't build. And the fact that we have advantages simply based on how we look when we walk down the street that another person walking down the street who looks differently doesn't have, that's not something that I caused. It does benefit me, though. And I don't feel guilty about it, but I recognize that that's unjust, and with that recognition comes a responsibility to act.
Right, and to take the part of the other, which is really what so much of this is calling us to do. Paul is dealing with a comparatively minor issue, but it's a real issue, and it's fraught with all kinds of meaning. It's the problem of meat sacrificed to idols in the first century church. There's a moral conundrum that faced certain Jewish Christians of tender conscience. And the moral conundrum was, can you eat meat that you buy at the marketplace? Why? Well, because unlike going to Safeway and buying your whatever it is, you Piggly Wigglies or whatever it is you have out there in the East Coast, is there a Piggly Wiggly's? Does that still exist? I don't even know.
It does exist. It's mostly a Southern thing.
Oh, okay.
I think there might be one in Philadelphia.
All I know about Piggly Wiggly's is that you use them to carry around fake nerve gas so that people will not know that the aliens are at Devil's Tower. But that's my expertise on Piggly Wiggly's. But at any rate, the meat that you bought at market in the first century came by and large from temple sacrifices. And so you would go offer, you know, a bull or something to Apollo at the temple of Apollo in Corinth. And once the bull was done being sacrificed and some of its flesh had been used in a ritual meal by which you participated in the life of the god, then the rest of it, you know, temple priests got to eat. They got to make money and stuff. So they would take the rest of the bull and they would sell it at market. So the question that bugged early Christians was, if I go to market and buy this bull that might have been offered to Apollo, am I somehow participating in the sacrifice to the god and therefore angering the true god? And so the early church's worries about this, and there's all kinds of tension about it. And so what Paul does is he tells the Corinthians, don't worry about it. Just give thanks to God for whatever it is you're eating and be about your business. You know, God made the bull. You're not trying to, you know, worship Apollo by having a hamburger. So just enjoy your meal. But he also goes, he adds that if his eating meat is a temptation to somebody else with a weak conscience to violate their own conscience, then he won't eat meat, even though he knows it's perfectly fine to do it, because he puts himself in the place of the other and thinks about them first, and he forgoes his own rights as a Christian for the sake of the other. And that attitude is sorely lacking in discussions of things like racism, because people are so on pins and needles about the possibility that someone somewhere thinks that they're a racist, so the whole white guilt thing, that no thought is given to, you know, well, what do you suppose, you know, a Black Catholic member of our community makes of it when he passes a big Confederate statue that commemorates the the triumph of the white race, which, I mean, there are statues that have plaques on them that say things like this, right? Why are we defending that, you know? People say, well, it's part of history. Well, you know what? There's an entire World War II memorial down at the mall in Washington, D.C., commemorates the valor of our troops in this immense battle against the gravest threat to Christian civilization in the 20th century. And yet, no statues of Hitler or the Nazi high command are there. Somehow we still managed to remember Hitler and the Nazi high command, even without that statuary, because the grammar of statuary is to honor. That's what it means. That's why we don't have big statues and busts of Margaret Sanger, you know, in.
Well, we do have to be clear, and we have to be clear there that there's more than one kind of statue. Okay. And this is something that is overlooked in a lot of this discussion.
Okay.
Is, you know, Rodin's The Kiss, for instance.
Right.
Versus the Monument to the Unknown Soldier.
Right.
There's a statue that is a work of art that exists for aesthetic purposes.
Right.
And then there are those statues which we call monuments or memorials, and these are statues with a political purpose and not a private political purpose, like a sculpture that is made by an artist either for himself or herself or for a private donor, but artwork which is commissioned by the state.
Yeah.
And which exists in open public places. That kind of statuary, memorials and monuments, that has that specific purpose that you mentioned,
right,
of glorifying, of celebrating, of standing as a statement for our values. People who say, well, you know, keep the statue of General Lee there, but put a plaque talking about the evils of slavery and so forth, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, you're taking the grammar and the logic of public art and you're trying to reinterpret it or spin against it with
right,
words and a plaque, and that's
right,
not the way that memorials and monuments work.
Yeah. Well, a reader of mine, John Madai, said, hey, let's put a statue of William Tecumseh Sherman in every major city in Georgia. That's not going to happen. Why? Because the grammar of such statuary is to honor. Southerners would argue, and, you know, by the way, I would agree with them, that William Tecumseh Sherman was a war criminal, and that you don't honor that. You do not honor the acts of a war criminal. And so the whole, well, we have to preserve our history by keeping up statues. Yeah, no, you don't. You really don't. You know, there are these things called books. You can learn a great deal about the Civil War from them, and you don't need to publicly honor. Another argument that comes up: there are two groups of people that say this. One is a tiny knot of super hard left Jacobins, and the other is the President of the United States and all of his defenders, who say, well, if you take down Confederate statuary, then you have to take down every statue of every founder who was a slaveholder or who, you know, defended slavery in some way. So we have to tear down the Jefferson Memorial and, you know, blow up Mount Vernon and all the rest of these kinds of things. Well, no.
And it turns out that there are actually, you know, an extreme minority of iconoclasts who, yeah, they want to do all that.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You know,
right,
there's a tiny minority on the left that argue this. There is a, and then there's the president and his millions of defenders who make this argument. But, you know, here's the thing, of course. Yes, the founders were deeply flawed men. Thomas Jefferson is kind of an icon of the again, what we're talking about, really in a theological sense, of what we mean by original sin. that original sin radically damages, but does not destroy the image of God. We are not Calvinists. We don't believe that the image of God is utterly annihilated by original sin, that nothing is left of the good in the person. And so as Catholics, we can look at a figure like Thomas Jefferson and say, you know what? Thomas Jefferson was a great man who his intellectual contributions to the American Revolution, his authorship of the Declaration of Independence is one of the, you know, the Declaration of Independence is one of the great political statements in the history of the human race. People will still be reading the Declaration of Independence 1,000 years from now. And deriving real benefit from it. And, you know, he was a great president and he did great things. He was also a man who owned human beings and who beat them and raped them, apparently.
Yes.
And you know what? Both of those things are true about that man. Mm-hmm. But the public statuary concerning him is not celebrating the fact that he was a hypocritical, by the way, slaveholder who condemned slavery but never got rid of his slaves. It's not there to celebrate that. It's there to celebrate what was really good and great in his contributions to our history. Now, compare that with Confederate statuary. What does it exist to do? It exists to celebrate a regime whose raison d'etre was the preservation of slavery, and yes, was, by that, the way,
that really is something that the critics of removing the Confederate statuary are glossing over when they appeal to the flaws of men like Washington,
right,
and Jefferson, is that the Confederacy came into existence fundamentally with the purpose of preserving the institution of slavery, and white supremacy was central to its self-understanding.
Yes.
That's why the states seceded. Now, slavery and white supremacy were present at the founding of the United States of America, but that's not why we broke away from
exactly
England, and that's not what we enshrined in our Declaration of Independence.
Exactly. And so what the Confederacy did was it made war on the good things that the founders did in order to preserve the worst things that the founders
that they tolerated
did.
Or
yeah,
made,
exactly.
Made space.
Yeah. And so, you know, why don't we tear down all the statues of George Washington and, you know, Thomas Jefferson? Because that's not what those statues exist to celebrate. What the Confederate statues exist to celebrate and to reinforce is the Jim Crow system that came into being as a result of the Confederacy's loss.
Yeah. So you really have in a way four semiotic levels when you examine these Confederate statues. You have the original basis for the Confederacy in the first place, the cause of secession and the cause of the forming of the Confederate States of America, and the justification for which they were willing to go to war, which was centered on slavery and white supremacy. Mm-hmm. You have the circumstances in which the statues were originally erected. This is the second level, which is fundamentally tied to Jim Crow and to the injustices of that time, to the intimidation and the lynchings and so forth. You have the third level of interpretation around the civil rights movement, where these statues again became popular as a way of pushing back against the push for equal civil rights. And now you have the fourth level, which is what we see in Charlottesville.
Right.
These are now the rallying cries for
Nazi white supremacists.
Right, exactly. And yeah, at this point, a lot of Christian Southerners who are strongly inclined to fight for tradition and to hold on. You know, they're starting to say things like, you know, this is we're getting to the point where these statues are like, you know, Moses' bronze serpent when it became an idol. At some point, you have to smash the thing.
Yeah, although the analogy limps because Moses' bronze serpent initially had a good purpose. These statues never had a good purpose. Right. Their purpose was to reinforce Jim Crow. And and so, you know, it's, I mean, one thing that's heartening, you know, is that there are a lot of Southerners who are saying, you know, what are we defending again? You know, and that's heartening to see, you know, that there are, and particularly the rising generation is looking at this and going, yeah, I'm not buying any of this. Now, of course, the thing that's disheartening is that the alt-right is primarily young, you know, and these are, you know, white guys and women, you know, who somehow feel like, I don't know, somebody is gypping them or threatening them or taking something away from them. You know, I was looking at all these, you know, these well-fed guys with tiki torches, you know, and I just kept thinking, you got the world at your feet. What are you whining about? It's just get on with your life. Stop worrying about all of this crap, you know, but this has become their identity. And it's appalling. So,
well,
go ahead.
I just want to say to that this is a reason to absolutely, yes, emphatically and unequivocally denounce the evils that they have chosen to associate themselves with, but find a way of doing so. This is hard. This is really hard.
Yeah.
But find a way of doing so without necessarily shutting down the conversation with them.
Mm.
When I say this, I get people who come back to me, you know, people who have been traumatized, people who have been threatened. Yeah. And they say, you know, how much do you want me to make myself a victim here? And, you know, I'm not here to tell anybody what to do.
Yeah.
But I think that these are people who are seeking an identity in provocation and in outrageousness because they feel on some level like they don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't found something else to tell them who they are and where they fit in this world.
There are.
I think that these are people who can be shown another narrative and who can be given another path if you can connect with them.
Well, this is, you know, and of course, this is the radical instinct of the gospel that leaves the 99 and goes out and, you know, looks for the one. And one of the things, this brings me to something that I also want to bring in. One of the more appalling and to me ridiculous complaints that I saw during all the kerfuffle about this was the complaint that people opposing Nazis are, and this is one of these trendy terms that's arisen in the last couple of years, they're virtue signaling. No, virtue signaling is bad. You don't want a virtue signal. And so if you say that you're opposed to Nazis, you're just virtue signaling. Well, what does that mean? Well, the gospel talks about virtue signaling. Jesus says, be sure that you don't do your acts of righteousness to be seen by human beings and praised for that. That's virtue signaling. So you can virtue signal about all kinds of things. A lot of it is culturally conditioned. In Jesus's day, standing on a street corner and praying publicly was not seen as weird and ridiculous as it would be today, but it was seen as that guy is really holy. He's really serious. And so Jesus says, don't do that because you'll have your reward. God knows what you're really doing. You're just trying to get people around you to say that you're awesome. But we can virtue signal about all kinds of things. I recycle, Steve. You know, that's virtue signaling. Whatever you do that will gain you the approval of your peer group is virtue signaling. Now, the irony of this, of course, is that depending on your peer group, it can be virtue signaling, or it can be a real act of courage and fidelity to the gospel to do the exact same action. So in my peer group, of Orthodox Catholics, saying that I'm pro-life can be, if I do it in order to gain their praise, that's virtue signaling. I'm just doing it so that other pro-lifers will say that I'm a righteous person and all the rest of it. And in another, in another circle, saying that I'm pro-life could be a real act of courage, because I know that that group of people is going to despise me for saying that. And when we're talking about opposition to Nazis, it's just, for the vast majority of people, it's not virtue signaling to say Nazis are bad. It's just common decency. And when the occasion calls for it, we have to say such things. And, when the occasion...
If only for the sake of the people who are threatened and who have, suffered the intimidation.
For the sake of the people who are threatened, for the sake of scandalized onlookers, again, we get back to the question of eating meat, sacrifice to idols. If somebody is looking at the church from the outside, trying to understand, they're attracted to the church for some reason, and they want to know more about it, and they happen on a group of Christians who were saying, well, you have to understand the Nazis, and their hurt feels, and it's so important to recognize that the people that they ran over weren't angels too, and all of that, the person looking at the church is going to say, goodbye. It's very clear where your sympathies lie, and you're making excuses for Nazis, and I will never consider the claims of the Catholic Church ever again if that's what you guys stand for. At a moment like that, it is not virtue signaling. It is evangelical witness to say no to this and to reject it unemphatically, unequivocally, and make it clear that there is absolutely no way that this is compatible with the faith.
Absolutely.
And the appalling thing was, I watched, after Charlottesville, as lots and lots of Catholics gave this kind of mealy-mouthed excuse-making stuff, and it is a scandal. And one of the ways that they gave scandal was by saying, oh, everybody that speaks against Nazis is just virtue signaling. No, that's not true. So anyway, I wanted to make that clear. We were also going to talk on a related subject about a film that you just reviewed.
We were, but we don't have time for that.
We don't have time for that.
We've got to wrap this up.
We got to wrap it up. Okay. Well, we're out of time. But I want to thank you so much, Steve Gerdonis, for your common sense witness to the faith and your sturdy willingness to put up with abuse for saying what is just obviously the teaching of the church here. So God bless you. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. You've been listening to Stephen Gerdonis, Deacon Stephen Gerdonis, and me. And I'll be back again in a week or so. Bye-bye.